We do welcome you to this service today. Sometimes we don't always know exactly what everybody's needs are. And if you have a specific need you'd like to share, then in the bulletin is my phone number and email, and I'll be glad to serve as a gatekeeper to make sure that whatever needs to be done can be addressed. So if there's something that we don't know about that you need help with, please let us know. A little more than a week ago, the Oklahoma City Thunder traded Russell Westbrook to the Houston Rockets for Chris Paul and a first-round draft choice in 2024 and a first-round draft choice in 2026. A cynical reporter said it this way. They sent Chris Paul to the Rockets. They sent Westbrook to the Rockets for Chris Paul, a seventh grader, and a fifth grader. Now, I'm not sure the math actually holds up, but it does make a pretty important point there. You know, somebody in 7 years from now is going to be drafted to play on this professional basketball team. We don't even know what's going to happen in 7 years. The world may be in such a precarious state that we don't even care about basketball in 7 years. I'm not predicting that's going to happen, but that's certainly a possibility. It appears like that's a long, long way down the road, and it certainly can be. Sometimes when you hear about contracts, you know, this contract will be filled in 2032. It's like, wait a second, how can you even plan that far in advance? We kind of get used to the fact that there's always going to be another day. There's going to be another year. And we kind of get into the pattern of living that way. From the musical Annie, the sun will come out tomorrow. Bet your bottom dollar, tomorrow there'll be sun. There's going to be another sunshine tomorrow. Well, Scripture gives us a different perspective on that. And God is constantly saying, through various sources, prophets, various writers, through Jesus, you need to be ready because you don't know what's going to happen next. In James chapter 4, as we finish this chapter together this morning, I'd ask you to look as we examine verses 13 through 17 of that fourth chapter. It's a passage you're going to know, and certainly this is just a reminder, but I think it's an important and pertinent reminder. Now listen, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to this or that city, spend a year there, carry on business, and make money. Why, you do not even know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? You are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if it is the Lord's will, we will live and do this or that. As it is, you boast in your arrogant schemes. All such boasting is evil. If anyone then knows the good they ought to do and doesn't do it, it is sin for them. These passages kind of fit in a sequence, and they really fit together in a progression, and that's who I'm going to look at them this morning. We pick up those two verses at the beginning of verses 13 and 14. Time is a construct created by God. He made it. He controls it. He uses it for his purposes. And sometimes we're confused by it. God has no beginning. God has no end. Eternity has no end. There's going to come a time in our existence, our spiritual existence, when time is going to actually be concluded. And we really have a hard time dealing with that, understanding what takes place in those situations. In 1999, I did a funeral for an elderly saint. Her name was Minnie Stout. And Minnie died in the summer of 1999. She was born in the summer of 1900. And so, except for the first 6 months or so of 1900 and the last 6 months or so of 1999, she lived the entire 20th century, or came very, very close. She had seen so much. And she was fortunate to be in good health for a very long time in her life, well into her 90s. And she was always an interesting person to talk to. I asked her one day, what was the worst thing that ever happened to you in your life? And she said, putting two sons on the train together to go to World War II. And then she said, but the best thing that ever happened in my life is that both of them came home. She had a great image of what life was all about. But one of the things that I can recall hearing her say a number of times is, where did the time go? Where'd the time go? You'd think that somebody who got to live 99 years, most of them full healthy life, would say, wow, I had so much time. But she didn't, because it gets away from us so quickly. Funerals are not something that we enjoy going to. I've done more than 300 funerals. And that's one of the things that I always try to say, is that this occasion reminds us of how fragile life is. Some of those, the vast majority of them, were elderly people. Some of them were young. Some of them were teenagers. Some of them were preschoolers. Terribly, terribly sad situations. And we sit back and we say, I don't want to go there. I don't want to think about those kinds of things. And God is reminding us that our time, either collectively, time itself can end, or our individual time on this earth can be over. If you look at verse 15, instead, you ought to say, if it is the Lord's will, we will live and do this or that. We have this beautiful image in verse 14 of this mist. You know, we know what mist is. We've gotten up in a morning and seen a beautiful picture like that, and know that within a couple of hours that burns off. We've watched pots on the stove as the steam rises, and we can see that situation and see as it goes away. And we know how quickly that mist moves on. And when James comes up with that as an analogy, it becomes really a powerful one for us, because we can see that. We can experience that. And he says, that's what your life is. It's literally being diffused each and every moment, until you look up or somebody else looks up and says, where'd it go? What happened? All along through this process, God is sovereign. We're looking at the future. And some people say, is it wrong to plan for the future? Well, absolutely not. James isn't telling us here that you can't go and do business. James isn't telling us that you can't make a plan. What's he telling us? Well, verse 15 makes it clear. It's we do all this within the context of God's will. My grandmother used to say, Lord willing, Lord willing. And some of there are older people that you could probably remember who said that as well. Sometimes that got to be maybe too habitual. But I do think that there were plenty of times in her life when she was thinking about the fact that this may not happen because God may intervene. I may not actually have this opportunity. And the reality of that, as James is telling these folks, is God can do what he wants. Why are we refugees? Why have we left Jerusalem and Judea? Why have we been the ones that have been forced out of home? Well, God can do what he wants. And there are positive things that are going to come out of their displacement. We simply respond in faith when God takes action. We say, Lord, whatever your will is in this, I'm willing to do. And that certainly is frequently painful in our lives. I couldn't help but think of Bible characters who've done that very thing. I thought first of Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 6, verse 18. God asked the question, the angel asked the question, who will we send? And Isaiah says, here am I, send me. Why not me? Genesis, we see Joseph. And he's been in a bad spot. His brothers have sold him. He had a good thing happen living in Potiphar's house. And now Potiphar's wife is taking advantage of him, or attempting to take advantage of him. And he says, how can I sin against God this way? And I think he understands on some level there's going to be consequences for that choice. God calls to Moses 40 years late and says, I want you to go rescue my people. And Moses is not at all excited about doing that. One of the excuses that he has is, who am I going to tell him told me to come here? You can just hear God saying, I am has sent me to you. I am has sent me. And it seems to close the argument for Moses. Mary, probably a teenage girl. I'm always so impressed when the things are explained to her that are going to happen to her, the way that she's going to be the mother of the Messiah. Her response is simply, I'm the Lord's servant. What's God's will? I'll do that. And even Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, and last of all, he appeared to me also as one abnormally born out of time or born out of season, as some of the versions say. We don't know anything about the future. We don't know if we have another day, collectively or individually. We don't know. But God says, I do know. I control the future. I understand the future. And he reaches out to us and he offers us his hand. And he says to us, do you want somebody to help you move into the future? And which hand would be more appropriate than the person who, or the being that controls the very future that we enter? Verse 16. As it is, you boast in your arrogant schemes. All such boasting is evil. I couldn't help but wonder how many sunrises I had seen in my life, so I did some quick calculation. I won't tell you the exact number, but it's more than 24,000. 24,000 sunrises. Well, you kind of get to the place where you start to think there's automatically going to be another one. We get into a pattern. We make plans, and the plans succeed. And after they succeed, we pat ourselves on the back and we say, good job. You did great. You were a success. And this passage tells us that what goes through God's experience is, that's arrogance. That's arrogance. You're being arrogant about this being successful. This was only successful because I aided in this. It was only successful because I gave you the tools to make it succeed. Whether it's intellect or material things or whatever, it all comes from and through God. Tower of Babel in Genesis chapter 11. Come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens so that we may make a name for ourselves. These people in early history had already started to think that they were in control. They could build all the way to heaven. And God says, you've got a lesson to learn. And I'm going to lead you through that process. About 10 years ago, my car broke down on the highway. And it wasn't possible to drive it, so I had to call a tow truck, and the tow truck came. And I called the place where I typically took my car at that point in time, and I said, I've had a breakdown, I'm having it towed to your garage. And the girl says, no, don't bring it here. And I said, why not? She said, it'd probably be a month before we could even look at it. I said, our place is crowded. I said, well, what do you suggest? And she said, take it somewhere else. And I said, okay, I'll take it somewhere else, but I want you to know that I'm going to keep taking it to that somewhere else place. And she said, well, obviously, we have plenty of business. I drive by that garage, and guess what it is now? It's closed. There's some storage that takes place there. Now, I don't know if that attitude was the reason that the place closed down, but it couldn't have helped in that process. When we get to the place where we say, I have enough, I'm in fine standing, I've got everything that I need, get away from me, I can take care of myself, then I think God looks at us and says, you're being a little arrogant there, and it might be good if we taught a lesson. He who humbles himself will be exalted. And when you exalt yourself, we have the promise from God that we're going to be humbled. And really, that's a process we want to avoid. Verse 17. This passage is hard to connect to the previous passages, and so I'm not even really going to try to do that this morning. It is important to us, though, that in Scripture there is a place that specifically addresses sins of omission. We know and we understand and we can figure that out and see that if we know to do something and we don't do it, then that's a sin when we fail to respond. But it is awfully good that James seeks and does include in this situation the specific saying of, if anyone then knows the good they ought to do and doesn't do it, it is sin for them. Time marches on, moves on quickly. Sometimes it moves so quickly that it's hard to measure it. And then, lo and behold, these things come up, these highlights or these historical landmarks. 50 years ago yesterday, man walked on the moon. 50 years ago. Now, I can date the audience really easily. There are the people who remember that, and there are the people who don't. Some of you are going, I remember. I was a high school senior. I just finished my senior year of high school. About a month later, would be going off to college. And that was a wonderful, kind of exciting time in my life. Our whole family sat in the living room and watched this incredible event. It was an event that wasn't something that crept up on Americans. We had seen this process take place. 1961, Alan Shepard had been launched into space. The first suborbital trip, he went up, came down very quickly. He got to school that day. It happened early in the morning, and every kid in school had their pencil flying like a rocket. We had show and tell, and every single kid told the same story. It got really boring to hear, you know, about the rocket going up again. These people became heroes. There were deaths along the way. The first of the Apollo missions struck by a fire. When those guys went to the moon, there were no guarantees. Some trips had taken place earlier where they'd gone up and circled the moon and come back. But this was the time they were actually going to leave that command module and get into that lunar excursion module and land on the face of the moon. Was it possible? They didn't know until they did it. They had been able to practice that to some degree and create some kind of situations that were similar, at least, to what those guys were going to face. They landed, as I understand it, with a whole extra 20 seconds of fuel. Walked out on the face of the moon, made this famous statement. So we watched on television these rickety pictures come back as the American flag is posted there. All kinds of happiness taking place that man has walked on the moon and America did it. And yet, if you remember that time, there was a tremendous amount of fear, even while you watched those guys walk around, because they still had to leave. There still had to be a moment when they lifted that top portion of the limb back up. And that had never been done in any kind of similar circumstances. It was totally a theoretical thing. Sure, it ought to work, but will it work? There was so much doubt that presidential speechwriters wrote a speech for President Richard Nixon to give in the event that they weren't able to lift off of the moon. And 30 years after the landing, they actually released that speech. And it begins by saying, fate has ordained that the men who went to the moon to explore in peace will stay on the moon to rest in peace. These brave men, Neil Armstrong and Edwin Aldrin, know there is no hope for their recovery. They also know that there is hope for mankind in their sacrifice. Can you imagine that they wrote those words thinking that may actually have to be said? Those three astronauts, of course, could not find life insurance. They really couldn't. And NASA wanted to do something about that. And so what they did was they printed postcards about the mission. Those men signed, autographed hundreds, if not thousands, of postcards. They were postmarked on the day that the rocket was launched. And they stood for the families to be able to sell them to collectors in the event that their men were not able to come home, so that their families could be provided for. The Apollo guidance computer weighed 70 pounds and was less powerful than the average smartphone. You probably have seen the headline that says, "The first supper on the moon was the last supper." And of course, that's play on communion. Edwin Buzz Aldrin, this was a Sunday, and he decided that he wanted to have communion. And so, as a part of the bag that was given for him to put his personal belongings in, he included a communion set so that he could do that literally on the face of the moon. This morning, we've communed together. We've testified that we believe in Jesus. We've testified that we believe that Jesus is coming again. We've testified that across the construct of time, there was a time when God sent his Son, and we benefit from that sacrifice that he has made. This morning, we remind ourselves again that time is fleeting. It could be gone rather quickly. And maybe as you look back on your life, you wish that you had dealt with time a little more effectively or a little more efficiently. And maybe there's a lot of time left for you to straighten that out. Maybe you have smaller pieces of time that you've experienced or that you feel like you've let go in a negative or a less than positive place, maybe even a sinful place. But the truth is, no matter how much time we have left, we have now. That's really what the passage is about. It's about what are you doing right now? And if now your life needs to be different, make it different. If we can help you do that, we'd be glad to. While we stand and sing.